Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Caterpillar v. Shears.
May it please the court, this is William Howard, who is an argument from petitioner. This is Deputy Attorney General, 6 minutes to go.
Thank you. May it please the court. This is a products liability case involving a Caterpillar 920 front-end loader. The 920 is a multifunctional machine that's designed to be used in a variety of settings. BD Hold is a local distributor of the 920 and sold the 920 to the plaintiff's employer, Dick Shipping. When Holt sold the 920 to Dick Shipping, it had a rollover protective structure called a ROS attached as standard equipment. Dick Shipping bought the 920 to use between decks on ships. That's an intended use of the 920 where the ROS won't fit. And in fact, OSHA permits the ROS to be taken off under those circumstances. So Dick Shipping unbolted the ROS and took it off. Later, Dick Shipping moved the 920 for use in a warehouse. And that's a setting where the ROS is required and where OSHA does require the ROS. But the problem was Dick Shipping didn't put the ROS back on the machine. And that's where the plaintiff was injured. The plaintiff was and a co-worker were moving sodium sulfate in the warehouse under terrible conditions. The dust was so thick, the visibility was down to 4 feet. And the co-worker couldn't see the plaintiff's machine, rear-ended him, and that's when the plaintiff was injured. Now, the plaintiff here tries to paint this case as nothing more than a factual dispute that ought to be left to the jury, nothing more than a battle among expert witnesses. The plaintiff just wants this court to leave the case to the jury. But in fact, the points we raise here are duty points, and those are questions of law for the court. Now, the plaintiff makes three liability claims, a design defect claim that we should have designed the 920 in a way that it could not be operated without the ROS, a warning claim that we should have warned users never to use the 920 without a ROS, and then a negligence claim. And the Court of Appeals based its judgment solely on the failure to warn claim, so that's where I'd like to begin. Our position throughout this case has been that the risk of operating the 920 without a ROPS is obvious. And because it's an obvious risk, we don't have a duty to warn against it. And that's exactly what your honors held in the Seagram's case. If you look at the 920, it's obvious that when the ROPS isn't there, there's no protection. On page 15 of our brief, we have a picture of the 920 with a ROPS and a picture of the 920 without a ROPS. And if you look at those pictures, it's obvious that when the ROPS is removed, there's no protection. And that's exactly what the plaintiff's own expert said. The plaintiff's expert, Walter Buford, said that when the rollover protective structure, when the ROPS is removed, it's obvious that there's no protection. We don't have a duty to warn. Now, the plaintiff tries to avoid Seagram's by claiming that the court should just defer to the jury. That's why he talks about the legal sufficiency standard of review. This is just a fact question for the jury. But Seagram's and every other duty to warn case has said this is a question of law for the court. Seagram's itself was decided on special issues. Seagram's, your honors, didn't wait to see what the jury said about the obviousness issue. The court decided it on special exceptions. And this is consistent with the law and the cases in other jurisdictions. We cite several cases on pages 16 to 18 of our brief. We cite several cases in other jurisdictions. They all hold, if the risk is obvious, there's no duty to warn, and they all hold that as a matter of law. In not one of those cases did the court suggest or intimate that this is a question of fact that ought to be left to the jury. And in fact, this rule makes sense. The point of a duty rule is to put consistency and predictability into tort law. It's to allow the court to be a gatekeeper to determine which cases get submitted to the jury and which cases don't get submitted to the jury. That's the point of duty rule. Those points, those goals would be lost if the duty questions themselves were simply submitted to the jury.
What if it's not clear whether a risk would be obvious to a reasonable person under those circumstances?
Well, our position is that if there's a dispute about it, it's still for the court to decide. We say that's consistent with Seagram's, it's consistent with the cases in other jurisdictions and is consistent with the goal of duty rules. So even if there's a dispute about whether it's obvious or whether it's clear, that would be for the court to decide. Otherwise, the duty questions are going to go to the jury.
How can we decide for a Caterpillar operator what's open and obvious?
Well, how the court can decide for a particular operator? Well, in our case, that's an easy question. The pictures show that it's obvious. I don't think we have a dispute here as to whether it's obvious in this case. If you look at the pictures, it's like a convertible with the top down. It doesn't have rollover protection. The ROPS obviously is not there.
Mr. Powers, it may be obvious to you, but Mr. Sears says, I've been a front load operator for 18 years, and it was not obvious to me, and had I known it was dangerous, I would not have gone on that front load.
Okay, we agree that that's Mr. Shears' own testimony. But again, the test here, and Mr. Shears, the plaintiff's trying to argue that it's a subjective test that's dependent upon his state of mind. Seagram's itself makes it clear that it's not a subjective test. In Seagram's, the plaintiffs allege that they personally were not aware of the risk of alcohol or alcoholism, and yet the court still, on special exceptions, said this is a question for the court to decide. So Seagram's says that it's not the plaintiff's own state of mind, it's what an ordinary user of the product would know.
That's the same question that comes in on breach of the duty. Once the court determines that a duty exists, then that same issue comes back as a question of fact and trying to decide if there's been a breach of the duty.
Well, it's similar to the breach issue in the following way, that on a warnings case, on the breach issue, the court will ask the jury to ask whether the product was unreasonably dangerous and will define it by asking, was that dangerous beyond what would be contemplated by an ordinary consumer? But our view is that obviousness isn't quite that issue either. There may be issues as how dangerous does the lack of warning make a particular product. For example, does the lack of warning in a drug not to be used or instructions for use not to be used in a particular circumstance, does that make the product too risky or more risky than an ordinary consumer would understand? That may depend on how often the drug is used in that circumstance. So there may be fact questions on whether, if there's a duty to warn, the failure to warn actually makes the product too dangerous. But our position is that obviousness is different. You can just look at this product, look at the 920, and the ROPS is gone. It's obvious to anyone. And in fact, again, that's what the plaintiff's own expert said. This is obvious, so when you take the ROPS off, there's no protection. But coming back to, just for a moment, to the plaintiff's own subjective state of mind, it's not just Seagram's that says that. Right, we talk about a Fifth Circuit case, Gray versus Manitowoc Company. The question there was whether there was a risk of a blind spot in a crank. The issue was whether it was obvious and therefore whether the crane manufacturer had to warn against it. The plaintiff said he didn't know about the risk. And the court said that testimony not just wasn't dispositive, was irrelevant. It's an objective test, not a subjective test. And again, that makes sense. The point of a duty to warn rule is to let the manufacturer know what warnings ought to be given at the time the product is sold. Now, the manufacturer can make some determination of what the ordinary user of a product would be. Here, skilled load operator. That's something the manufacturer can determine. But if the outcome awaited the subjective state of mind of the particular plaintiff, there'd be no way for the manufacturer to predict what kinds of warnings to give at the outset. It would all depend on something that was going to happen after the product.
And this is only limited to a warnings case?
This is
your argument? Open and obviousness of the risk?
Correct. We are not attacking the patent danger rule in design cases or trying to resurrect the patent danger rule in design cases or negligence cases or premises liability cases, as the plaintiff suggests. We're just saying that open and obvious there's no duty if it's open and obvious in a warnings case, which again is precisely what your honors held in the Seagram's case.
Ms. Powers, is there you're arguing this obviousness, but isn't in these cases that you cite the obviousness tied to the conduct of the operator of the machine? In other words, the blind spot in the operating of the crane, the operator gets injured. Isn't the obviousness tied to an ordinary operator would have recognized this and therefore have conducted them, their affairs differently. Whereas in this circumstance, I mean, obvious about the roller protection, I look at this machine, I know it's obvious that it's susceptible of rolling over. It doesn't have a canopy on it, so I therefore need to be careful operating the machine versus someone who says, this machine, somebody runs me down from the back with their front end loader up and crushes me. Isn't there a connection between the obviousness of the defect and the opportunity of the operator to correct for that obviousness?
Well, I think that, yes, I think that's correct. In the Crane case, in the Gray case, the question was whether it was obvious to the operator. That's right, the plaintiff who was hit, but the co-worker was the operator. And the operator could have done something to avoid the risk because it's obvious. So his theory was because if he'd known about this risk. But the co-worker also, the theory there was he wouldn't have gone behind the machine. So both plaintiffs in that case had an opportunity to avoid the...
But it had to do with the operation of that machine that was more dangerous because of this blind spot than less dangerous, but the operators could have corrected for it. In this case, this operator, there was nothing this operator was doing in particular that could have corrected for the lack of the overhead cover, or not.
The only thing the operator could have done in this circumstance was to have quit the job and not operated the machine. It is absolutely clear that Dick Shipping, the owner, was not going to put a ROPS on this machine. And we didn't know that when we sold the machine, but subsequent testimony from Mr. Ostis at Dick Shipping was that, you know, they would cut the ROPS off with a torch if they had to do it. They were determined not to put a ROPS on this machine. So the only way that Shears could have avoided this accident with the, even if there had been a warning given or if he had recognized the danger, would have been to not operate the machine, which I think would have meant quit his job under those circumstances. We have taken the position that a warning wouldn't have prevented this accident. But even if we had warned him, and Dick Shipping knew about this risk, Dick Shipping's the only one that could have put the ROPS back on. Our position is that Dick Shipping is the sole cause of this accident. This accident was caused by Dick Shipping's decision not to put the ROPS back on.
One of the main issues is that Caterpillar should have manufactured this item so that the ROPS could not have been
removed. That's right. That's their design defect claim. And on that issue, they're asking us to manufacture a multifunctional piece of machinery that's intended for use between decks on ships, that OSHA says it can be used between decks on ships without the ROPS. However, their theory is that we should have made this a permanent ROPS. Whether it's welding, they've changed their theory throughout the litigation. But whether it's welding or some other kill switch or some other device, their theory is we should have made this impossible to use in the very situation that Dick Shipping purchased the 920, that is between decks on ships. And there is not a case anywhere that says we have a duty. Now this is on the design issue, but we have a design duty, again a question of law for the court. Not a case anywhere that says we have a design duty to design a multifunctional piece of machinery in a way that would make it impossible to use in one of its intended uses. We cite the Elliott case out of the Fort Worth Court of Appeals, Verge out of the Third Circuit, the Hagens case out of the Fifth Circuit, multi-purpose truck chassis and a multi-purpose saw. In each of those cases, the court rejected the precise design claim that they're making in this case. That is, that we should have designed the 920 in a way that would make it absolutely impossible to use in the very function that Dick Shipping bought the machine to do.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear arguments from Ms. Bowman.
May it please the court, Mike Gallagher on behalf of the respondent, Mr. Shears. First of all, let me make the plaintiff's position clear in this case to the court. We do not contend this court needs to render in this case a ruling that's in conflict with that previously rendered in either De La Lastra or in the Seagram's case. Because in the Seagram's case, The court, in the opinion that was written by Justice Hightower, pointed out that the defect or the aspect of the product that caused the injury was one that was contemplated by comment J, that it was within the common knowledge of the community that people that engage in the drinking of alcohol on a repetitive basis will ultimately suffer the deleterious effects of that habit. But that's not the case that we have here, because while I would not contend that you need to warn of the fact that a gun will shoot or that a knife will cut, what we're talking about in this circumstance is an appreciation of the nature of the danger that's created by doing what the manufacturer intended and could foresee would be done, which was the removal of the rocks. And not only the removal, but also the failure of the party that removed it to replace it. Mr. Whitten, who was a technical director for Caterpillar, testified that not only would the removal was the removal of a foreseeable circumstance, but also the failure or the refusal to put the rocks back on was a foreseeable circumstance. And while Mr. Ostis of Dick Shipping, who was the employer of the plaintiff in this circumstance, may have that option to get, may want to employ that option, we say that as to people that occupy the position of the user, Mr. Shears, that the Caterpillar should do the very same thing that they did on their larger front-end loaders, which was a 950 front-end loader, which had a warning regarding do not use this front-end loader without the rocks in place. And the reason for that is that Caterpillar was aware, by virtue of training films and testing, that the rollover protective structure provided a margin of safety for an operator of their equipment, which when removed would eliminate the margin of safety. And the respondent confuses in this case the appreciation of the fact that the rocks is gone and has been removed with an appreciation of the fact that there's a danger, such as that which occurred in this circumstance, of being injured, perhaps fatally, but in this case certainly seriously, by virtue of a rear-end collision.
Mr. Gallagher,
yes,
to what extent should we, or what way should we give the fact that OSHA allows these type of front-end loaders to be used without rocks?
If one, OSHA, we contend, of course, does not apply to a manufacturer. But if someone says, well
OSHA was aware that Dick Shipping was using these front-end loaders without rocks, and they permit that.
Aware that the front-end loader was being used in a circumstance without the rocks.
And they allowed
between decks on ships, which was a use that was contemplated. However, it was not one of the principal uses of the equipment, but it was a use. But our position in response to your question is that if you're going to say, okay, let's design a rocks that can be removed to use in a certain isolated circumstance, then at least warn the operator of the fact that the removal of the rocks exposes them to a certain risk of harm which otherwise would not exist. And that was not done in this case. It is undisputed in the evidence. Mr. Staub, a retired engineer from Caterpillar, Mr. Whitten, one of their technical supervisors, Mr. Cameron, a gentleman that was employed by B.D. Holt, all testified unequivocally that the rocks provided a margin of safety which, when removed, was eliminated and exposed the operator to an extreme risk of harm up to and including the risk of being injured by collision. Frequently, we look at the rollover protective structure, you think of what harms or what dangers it might prevent or what danger it might insulate the operator from. The danger of collision is not one that readily comes to mind, unless you happen to occupy the position of Caterpillar in this case, whose training films and whose experience within their industry demonstrated that collisions between pieces of heavy equipment on construction sites, which are traditionally dusty, which are traditionally different from those that we encounter on the highway, frequently lead to collisions. We do not say that the existence of in this circumstance is a question of fact. It's a question of law, as this court pointed out in General Motors versus Sands.
Do you think the Court of Appeals said it was a question of fact?
I beg your pardon?
Do you think the Court of Appeals said it was a question of fact?
No, sir, I do not. At 928 of the opinion, what the court says, and it related to the question of open and obvious. In the light of this evidence, it's impossible to substitute our opinion for the jury's as to what is commonly known to a skilled operator of such equipment. We cannot substitute our view for that of the fact finder about whether the dangers of injury without the rocks are obvious as a matter of law. Now, the question of the...
So does that statement not make it a fact question? According to the Court of Appeals, according to that sentence you just read.
No, sir. I don't think that it does. I think what the Court of Appeals is saying and what we're saying is that the existence of a duty in any context, whether it's to be reasonable and prudent in the operation of your vehicle, or not conduct your affairs in violation of the DTPA, or not design a defective product, are all duties that are created by law and obligations that would not exist but for the law, whether it's judicially created law or whether it's law that's statutorily created.
How do you respond to Mr. Power's argument that even with a warning, if there had been a warning as you suggest, this would not have prevented the accident?
In this circumstance, I think in a no warning case, as was pointed out by Justice Heck in the Sains opinion, there's a distinction between a presumption that arises in a no warning case and a presumption that arose in that case in which you were dealing with an inadequate warning, which, if followed, would have prevented the accident from occurring. And in that circumstance, the court followed the logic of Magro and said if an appropriate warning had been given in a no-evidence case, if an appropriate warning has been given, it is presumed that the operator would have heeded the warning. Now, that presumption is buttressed by the fact in this case, which is a no-warning case as distinguished from an inadequate warning case, but it's buttressed by the fact in this case that Mr. Shears testified that had he been given a warning,
he would not have a job because Dick Shipley was going to use a front end loader, whether Shears was the operator or somebody else.
He would have reported it to the union. And whether or not the union would have been able to do anything about it remains to be seen. But Dick Shipley also said had they been warned and had they been aware of the dangers associated with the use of this equipment on the piece of equipment itself, that they would have heeded that warning. I believe the testimony came in through Mr. Dale, who was the safety supervisor for Dick Shipley. But in this circumstance, there's a presumption, Your Honor, because it is a no-warning case, that if the warning had been given, it would have been followed.
Counsel, how do you respond to the opening obvious argument of Mr. Powers? Anybody can see, any ordinary person, particularly a skilled operator, can see that one of those front-end loaders, with its lifter up, runs into another front-end loader with its lifter up, and the ROPS is not on there, somebody's going to be hurt.
I don't think that an operator can perceive the manner in which an accident might occur. In this circumstance, it certainly was not within the perception of Mr. Shears that the kind of injury that occurred was one that was going to occur. He testified he really wasn't, that he had never operated.
You've got more than one of these front-end loaders operating in a limited area under dusty conditions where vision's down to about 4 feet and not protected by rocks. It's not conceivable one of them could run into the other one?
It certainly was something of which Caterpillar was aware, but it wasn't something that was in the contemplation of Mr. Shears. He did not volunteer to be involved in a work situation in which the likelihood of injury was going to occur. Certainly he knew the ROPS was not on the machine, although he testified he'd never worked on one working on the docks down there that had a rollover protective structure in his 18 years. Being a skilled operator is considerably different from understanding the sophisticated science of safety engineering and understanding the manner in which a particular piece of equipment works, which this is not multifunctional equipment, by the way, and Hagen's involves a circumstance in which you have different points of operation because you're using a radial saw for different circumstances, and the risk of exposure to that rotating blade that is rotating at several thousand RPMs a second is considerably different from this case. This case, this piece of equipment, is today, was the day it was manufactured, and will be forever only a front-end loader with one point of operation. And that distinguishes this front-end loader from a circumstance in which you have multiple uses that prevent guarding. And when you're arguing
there's a distinction between multi-purpose and multi-circumstance?
I'm arguing that there's a distinction between a multi-purpose piece of equipment.
Multi-purpose piece of equipment can be used for a number of different purposes. A front-end loader can only be a front-end loader, but when it's utilized in different environments, OSHA has specifically authorized its use without a rocks between decks on ships, has it not?
An option.
Pretty obvious that you take the rocks off even between decks. You've got a dangerous piece of equipment, isn't it?
You certainly do. But it's an option that mandates the giving of a warning.
This accident had occurred between decks on a ship where it's authorized by OSHA to be used without the rocks. Would you say that the warning would still need to be given then when you've got this piece of safety equipment that has to be removed so you can use it between decks?
Certainly. I would say that if you're going to remove a piece of safety equipment that provides, by the testimony of all the defendant's experts and the experts that were proffered by the plaintiff, a margin of safety that can protect from fatal or permanently disabling injuries, as in this case, that when that piece of safety equipment is removed, that the manufacturer has an obligation in that circumstance, more so than any other circumstance, quite frankly, Justice Gamage, to warn of the fact that the danger of injury is enhanced by virtue of the removal. And this is not a question of law, it's a question of fact. The jury was asked the question, was this danger within the contemplation of the user? And that's more or less a shorthand rendition of what they were asking question number two. And that's what we're getting to here. Did the user... Yes, sir.
Were there any other safety devices on this tractor?
None of which I'm aware of, Your Honor.
I guess my question would be, if there was a safety switch that if the driver was thrown off the tractor and the switch would get pulled, should there be a warning in the event that somebody after the original manufacturer of the tractor disconnected that switch? Should there be a warning that says in the event this switch is ever disconnected by anybody, it will increase the danger of the operation of this vehicle?
The answer to that question, I think, depends to a large extent upon a weighing of the circumstance and the likelihood of injury. But in this particular case, there was an absolute awareness that this ROPS was developed to provide a 360-degree envelope of safety, not for just rollover situations, but from collisions on the job site. Because they're operated, Justice Gamage, in circumstances in which there is limited visibility.
Well, I think where my question is going, it's undisputed that it came from the manufacturer with that on it.
Yes, sir.
Now, the argument is that the manufacturer knew that this protective device would be removed. And even if they didn't know that, you'd argue that they should have known it was reasonably foreseeable that this item would be removed, and therefore it should have been mounted permanently. My question is going, as to any item that a manufacturer manufactures, should they have a warning with regard to every item of safety that they originally install, indicating that if each of these items of safety have ever been removed, that they ought to be reinstalled before the vehicle is operated? I mean, how far do we go with the warnings as to each item of safety that has originally been installed by the manufacturer?
I can only answer your question by alluding to the testimony of Caterpillar's technical supervisor, Mr. Whitten, in this case. And in this case, in the evidence that was provided to the jury, he testified that having a warning such as that which Caterpillar themselves had on the 950 front-end loader, very same kind of equipment, just a little bit larger. And it had the warning that we say should be on the 920 front-end loader. And Mr. Whitten, technical supervisor, manager for Caterpillar, in response to the question that I asked, and in response to the question that you're asking, set a warning regarding the absence of the rocks and the enhancement of dangers associated with its removal would be a good idea.
Was the 950 authorized by OSHA for use under any circumstances without the rocks?
I think any wheeled front-end loader could be used in a circumstance in which could be used between decks. Sometimes between decks is a confined space, sometimes between decks.
Does it have removable rocks? Does 950 have one that can be unbolted, or does it have to be cut off?
On the 950, I'm not sure, but on exhibits 34 and 35, which we had, there were removable rocks, which when removed, one was designed by Caterpillar and the other thing by Michigan Corporation. And
my point is that you have one vehicle that is authorized by OSHA for use without the ROPS under certain circumstances. It has no warning on it. You have a slightly larger model that has a warning on it, also has a ROPS, I presume, that may or may not be authorized for use without the ROPS under certain circumstances. In other words, it's never authorized for use. If it's never authorized for use,
that's not the
rocks,
case.
The warning would be particularly meaningful, wouldn't it? If it is authorized for use without the ROPS, maybe you're arguing the warning would be even more meaningful? I don't know.
No, your assumption is not correct. There is not a specific authorization for a 920 front-end loader versus a 950 front-end loader to be used between decks. Any front-end loader, and the court needs to understand this, any wheeled vehicle that can be used in that space can have the ROPS removed for that removal. And between decks on a jumbo ship is considerably different than between decks on other kinds of vessels. And there is no exception for the 920 front-end loader. Not at all. There's no distinction between the 920 and the 950. Yes,
and
yes, sir.
And the advertising material that Caterpillar put out in regard to this particular front-end loader, did they advertise it as one that had a ROPS that could be removed for use between decks of a ship? Was this one of the things that was a sales item for this piece of equipment?
I'm not sure what their sales data showed. I think the sales data does show that it can be removed, but it's interesting that the testimony of the retailer in this case, B.D. Holt, who has an office in the vicinity of Brownsville and who supplies people like Dick Shipping and these other people with rollover protected structures, said they would not sell one to a user who was going to remove the ROPS. And they would tell that person, sorry, you got to go somewhere else to buy your equipment. And that's the testimony of either Mr. Kammer or Mr. Whitten. I'm not certain which one. And that's the retailer. The manager, one of them had 35 years of experience. I forget how long the other one had been employed. They said, we will not sell one. I would not sell one to somebody who's going to remove the ROPS because of the dangers associated with its removal. And why would he not do that if in his perception it was open and obvious?
But you have no evidence that Caterpillar advertised this or advocated or suggested that the ROPS be removed for use under this circumstance.
In the context in which it was being used at the time of the injury, there was absolutely no exception to OSHA that applied. I think that's undisputed. As to whether or not they said you can remove the ROPS and operate this particular piece of equipment without the ROPS in certain circumstances, I think the information did show actual pictures of the front-end loader being used without the ROPS. But in response to Justice Gamage, there is no exception that says the front 920 front-end loader. It just says any wheeled, the exact wording in OSHA, that's being used between decks doesn't have to have the ROPS on it in that application.
You're, I suppose, saying that if the 950 had been the one in use and the ROPS had been removed because it had a warning, we'd have a different case here.
We would have a substantially different case here.
Dicks would not have taken it off, not allowed its use, and Shears would not have operated unless it had the ROPS on there because of that warning.
That's the only evidence that is in this record at this time. The only evidence that's in this record.
Were there big 950 models in use in the warehouse?
I don't think Dick Shipping owned any 950 routes.
Gallagher, are you suggesting by your earlier discussion of the Seagram's case that the rule articulated there in the court's opinion is limited to whiskey, or is it generally applicable to warnings cases, product liability warnings cases?
I think it's generally applicable, and I agree with the opinion in Seagram's, that if something is within the common knowledge. But when all the evidence in this case, Mr. Castillo, what's the ROPS for? Well, they use it for shade. Mr. Ostis, what are they? It's for weather protection. Mr. Shears himself, it's to protect you from the weather. I mean, that's what the perception of the guy that knows how to drive that machine all around down here for 18 years without a wreck, and he knows how to handle the controls and how to move it from the job from one job site to another. But they really don't have an appreciation. And what in essence Caterpillar is telling you that we ought to do in Texas is that if you make a product that the danger of that product is so open and obvious, then as a policy for this state, what we need to do is just not warn about anything, as long as it's open and obvious.
Does it take this case out of the rule in Seagram's if you have can adduce some testimony that by the operator of the vehicle, perhaps the person even got hurt, that it wasn't obvious to me? Does that then take it out of the Seagram's case?
No, I don't think it takes it out of the Seagram's case. That and that alone does not remove it from the purview of the Seagram's case. I think the court has to look at the facts and circumstances surrounding the context in which the testimony is given. For me to walk into a boiling, into a furnace and say I didn't know it was going to burn me, or put a gun in my mouth and pull the trigger and say I didn't know it was going to shoot me, it's the kind of thing of which the court can take judicial notice. That language was not employed in your Seagram's opinion. But
what about
an
automobile convertible that does not have rollover bars, and those are now being manufactured in quite large quantities again? Should that have a warning on the imprinted on the side of the car next to the logo? Does that fall in Seagram's case or in your argument about the case?
I think the convertible falls in Seagram's case. I think there's a better understanding of what you're looking at. Here, in the Seagram's case, if Mr. Sears, in the Shears case, if Mr. Shears was assuming a risk, or if there was a risk that was within his contemplation, it was a risk of rollover, if there was one at all. If you wanted to impose one as a matter of law, as you did in the Seagram's case, saying anybody that swills whiskey for 30 years knows they're going to have problems. And the court will take judicial notice of that, just as we will that there are 24 hours in a day or the sun rises in the east and sets in the west.
Should the court base that judgment on its general knowledge or on how many real stupid or real smart people are brought to testify in the trial court by the various sides?
I think the court has to weigh the evidence and make a determination as to whether there's any evidence. But if it's regarding something that is open and obvious, and you hire an expert, which as you know, Justice Phillips, having been on the trial bench, someone could do to say that, well, that danger is not open and obvious. That's not a question for expert opinion, by the way. Whether or not a danger is open and obvious is not, to me, a question that submits a proof.
But you're talking
based
about
upon
the
pedigree.
You mentioned other workers there, more experienced than Mr. Shears, who did not know the purpose of the rollover bars or the danger without them. Is that the kind of...
Yes.
Should the appellate court look to that kind of testimony in the trial court record to decide whether or not that this is open and obvious?
Certainly.
So not expert testimony, but just folks off the street.
In this context, I don't think an expert can tell you what's within the appreciation of the ordinary user. In fact, Mr. Buechler, in response to questions, said that he really couldn't speculate on what a skilled operator knew. He said, to me, I know that the risk of injury is greater because of the removal of the ROPS. And to the people at Caterpillar, they're experts. They knew that the removal of the ROPS exposed an operator to a risk of injury from collision. But yet,
You've got people out here who did not witness the test, were not engaged in the development of rocks, and they're the average user of the product, and they all say that no one said they thought it was to protect them from collisions with other vehicles, Justice Gamage. Nobody.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Professor Powers, why does Caterpillar have a warning on its 950 model and not on its 920?
Your Honor, Caterpillar does not have a warning on its 950 model. The testimony is that Mr. Whitten, somebody thinks they saw a warning on the 950. Our engineer categorically testified the 950 does not have a warning on it. So there's not a warning on the 950, though we agree there is testimony that somebody thinks they saw a warning on the 950. Also, the 950 is a bigger machine. It will not fit between decks on ships, even if the ROPS is taken off. By the way, the Michigan loader is a huge machine, won't fit between decks on ships. The 936, which they saw, in fact, does have a configuration. If you look at the material that provided you in the exhibits, does have a configuration without the ROPS. And as a general point, would just ask you to check the record on what we've cited in this regard. But in specific answer to the question, the 950 does not have a warning.
Does the 950 have a removable ROPS? Is it going to be unbolted or have to be cut off?
I'm not sure of that, and I'm not sure that's in the record. I believe the 950 has a boltable ROPS, but I'm not sure.
Do you know whether it's authorized for use without the ROPS under certain circumstances?
Well, if it's in, the authorization from OSHA is low clearance situations where the ROPS will not fit. The 950 is a huge machine. It's not used under those circumstances. So we would not contemplate that it would be used under those circumstances. There may be other situations where it had to get under a particular configuration in a construction site. And
where does the 936 come in the spectrum? Is between the 920 and 950?
The 936 is bigger than the 920 and smaller than the 950. They just follow the numbers.
It is usable between decks. You say
there's nothing in the record to indicate.
It has a configuration without the ROPS, you said.
It does have a configuration without the ROPS. An inference from that evidence is that there are configurations where the ROPS would not fit and it would be used. There's, other than the inference from that configuration, there's nothing, to my knowledge, in the record about the 936. I'd like to make two other points about the record here. Mr. Whitten, who they rely on as a Caterpillar expert and engineer, is not a Caterpillar expert and engineer. Mr. Whitten was a sales manager or a salesperson at B.D. Holt. Came to B.D. Holt in 1981 after this machine was sold, was not aware of the circumstances under which this machine was sold by B.D. Holt. There's no evidence in the record when he says, I can't imagine a situation where I take the ROPS off. There's no evidence in the record that he had a sales area that included places like Dick Shipman where the ROPS would be taken off. And also, it is uncontrovertible in this case that the 920 is used between decks on ships. OSHA contemplates front-end loaders will be used between decks on ships. And that's why Dick Shipman purchased it. So the fact that Mr. Whitten, again, who's not a Caterpillar person, thought maybe he wouldn't take the ROPS off is simply that he's not aware of the situations, didn't have that in the sales area where they would be taken off. I'd like to also point out, they say Mr. Shears didn't know about the risk of collision. If you look at volume 10, 653, Mr. Shears testified that he was aware of the risk of collision. Now, should we have warned about the particular nature of how this bucket might have hit this particular seat? Their expert, Mr. Buechler, said he'd never seen such an accident in 35 years of studying these kinds of accidents. We couldn't have warned against that, against the particular nature of the accident. The ROP is designed for rollovers, not as a protection against collisions. They're saying we should have warned the ROPS not to be taken off. That's because the ROPS, and we agree fully, that Dick Shipping should not have failed to put the rocks back on when it moved the 920 to the warehouse. That made it more dangerous than if the rocks had been there. But the purpose of the rocks is a rollover. The purpose of the rocks, it's a rollover protective structure. The purpose of the rocks isn't to protect against collisions. They had testimony that in this very odd angles in this particular case, it might have prevented this particular injury. But that certainly we didn't have a duty to warn against. That particular risk is an unforeseeable risk. And all of duty to warn law in Texas is that we don't have to warn against an unforeseeable risk. The point of whether this is a multifunctional machine, it is undisputed that this is a multifunctional machine. It's a machine that is sometimes used in settings where the ROPS is not required, between decks on ships, and sometimes used in a setting where the ROPS is required.
You say on the one hand that this is an open and obvious risk. It's an open and obvious danger that this kind of an accident like this, that you can have a collision accident resulting in injuries that would be particularly dangerous without the ROPS. But there's no, since the ROPS is there for rollover purposes, there's no duty to warn that you may be subject to injury from collisions if you remove it?
Well, their theory, both in their pleadings and at trial, was not that we should have had a warning on there, watch out for collision. Right? They keep changing their theory of recovery here. They said you should have warned, never use without the ROPS. Now, we agree in the way, first of all, that's a false warning. There are situations where it should be used without the ROPS. But the reason the ROPS ought to be there is because of the rollover. This was, as their experts testified, a freak accident because of the angles of the load.
Any other questions? Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument. The list called all the causes we've heard this morning will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments, and the marshal will please adjourn the court.
Okay.